decision about where to go to college, and are low-cost student loans ultimately leading to rising tuition? To address these and other questions, NPR's Renee Montagne spoke with Tim Maurer, a financial planner who counsels families about the true costs of college.
Why don't we start with how much access to these loans figure in decision-making by students and their parents about where to go to college?
I'm not sure that actually plays much of a role. I think the decisions are made prior to looking at the funding. This is what we're going to do. I think it's already a foregone conclusion that they're going wherever they're going. Then they're trying to figure out what to do with the money.
Okay, so a student who has their sights set on Princeton,
yes,
or UCLA,
mm-hmm,
or a smaller college, maybe less expensive than those two, that student applies and once accepted has to make this decision.
Ordinarily, that's what I see the case. Yeah. Now, you mentioned some of the Ivy League schools or the more expensive private schools. The Stafford loans that they've been talking about in the news these days, those loans only offer a maximum undergraduate-level education of $23,000. So you could be talking about less than 1 year at one of the private schools you mentioned. So they're probably going to end up taking a look at other loans, oftentimes the parent plus loans, which are already at a higher interest rate of 7.9%, and that's the loan that is on the parent, whereas the Stafford loan, that is the one that the student has themselves.
And the student loans, how easy are they to get? And then how easy are these other loans to get?
Surprisingly easy to get student loans of some sort or another. Remember, it's not the strangest thing to imagine that the academic institutions who want the students to come, want them to pay the tuition, they actually do a great deal of helping in students finding the loans that are going to suit them best. And at the end of the day, if they can't get federally funded loans with federal aid, you have institutional loans directly from the school themselves or some sort of outsourced institution.
We might want to remind people that student loans, inexpensive student loans, came about as a way of encouraging students to go to college and making college affordable.
Yes.
For students who deserve to go.
Well, the fear I have is that even though the ubiquity of student loans was designed to give opportunity to people at all economic levels, the drastic increase in tuition prices, the result has been that who is most impacted by that? It's actually the people who needed the help the most. It's middle-income and lower-income folks who will not be able to handle the debt load into the future. So that's the irony of the situation. Oftentimes, the best laid plans of mice and men oft go awry. And here we had a great idea that was intended to extend cheaper education to many, to give them upward mobility. The problem is now we could actually be killing the whole opportunity for upward mobility with the extreme cost of tuition prices.
Well, what are the key things that students and parents ought to be considering then?
There's very, very much of an emotional component to this decision-making process. Not just for the kids. Of course, the kids visit three different campuses and say, oh, this is the one that feels good. The parents also have this sense. We as parents have the sense these days that it's our duty to provide our children with the education that's going to put that starry look in their eyes, that's going to inspire them on to great heights professionally. And so there's so much of that emotion wrapped up into it. I absolutely value the experience of college for parents and students, but it's partly my job to bring it back down to earth and say, hey, look, after the 4 years, hopefully 4 years, is over, what you've got left is a diploma. And then you're out into the real world. For the most part, that diploma, especially for an undergraduate degree, is almost ubiquitous. Wherever you went, there's a lot of parity these days, even between Ivy League schools and the best in-state universities. So you have to be very, very careful about how much of your life and how much of your money you're going to invest in that educational experience.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Maurer teaches financial planning at Towson University in Maryland. He spoke with NPR's Renee Montagne. In Washington, D.C., the glittering marble of public buildings and monuments can conceal the darkest of deeds, and in the crime novels of Mike Lawson, they do. Lawson's written six thrillers featuring protagonist Joe DiMarco, a lawyer-turned-fixer for the Speaker of the House. As part of NPR's summer reading series Crime in the City, Linda Wertheimer reports on Lawson's novels and why he chose D.C. as his backdrop.
When I started writing, the very first decision I made was I wanted the book set in D.C. That was before I had a character or anything else. And the reason for that is I've always told people that D.C. is a target-rich environment for a writer. There's always something going on here, something corrupt or silly or sometimes heroic. And then the city itself, I love the city.
When Lawson got around to casting his thrillers, he created a lead character called Joe DeMarco, who works for the Speaker of the House doing what needs to be done. But Lawson stayed with his plan of making Washington, D.C. the jumping-off place, seeing the familiar sights of the city as good places for bad things to happen. For instance, in the book House Secrets, Lawson liked the entrance to a Senate office building as a setting for an assassination attempt.
The senator was going to walk through those doors right there, those double doors, and he was preceded by two Secret Service agents. And the agents, not thinking, they just sort of opened the door like doormen and sort of stood to the side. And at the bottom of those steps was this young kid who wanted to shoot the senator for a reason not worth going into. He fired a gun twice, and he hit the senator's aide. And the senator in this book is a fairly charismatic, lucky guy. And once again, he was lucky, even though he's the bad guy.
Sounds like a movie. Lawson needs to see what's happening. He likes to have a feel for where his characters hang out, like DeMarco's office. Exploring in the pre-9/11 days, when citizens could roam freely, Lawson decided Joe's office should be tucked away in the bowels of the Capitol building, so we went down there. Nowadays, of course, we need special passes for this kind of access.
Now, we're in one of the many basements of the Capitol. Roughly speaking, we're underneath where the speaker's offices are, so This is the kind of real estate you picked out for your hero to occupy?
Yes, it is. I walked into the Capitol, was in the rotunda, and I saw a set of steps with a little velvet rope across it, and I just stepped over the rope, and nobody stopped me or said anything, and then I went down two flights of stairs, and I remember seeing a corridor at the time. There's an emergency diesel generator room and a printing office and a janitor space, and I said, well, this is DeMarco's office.
This is an off-the-books office with a fake title on the door for a big guy with no job description.
He's essentially a fixer. I mean, he goes and does stuff that the speaker doesn't want on the books. There's some little problem to be taken care of. He doesn't really want tied to the office. He'll loan Joe out to friends, go do things for them. But he's basically a political fixer.
Joe's assignments are also reality-based. The Valerie Plame case, where a CIA agent is outed. In the newest book, The Bad Doings of Big Pharma, Testing New Drugs in the Third World. In a previous book, prophetic concerns about the president's protective detail. And most of the characters who move DeMarco's plots are vaguely familiar, too, although possibly meaner. Our next stop on the DeMarco tour, a Georgetown eatery called The Guards, which DeMarco likes because it's quiet and not too expensive. That's all true. Mike Lawson says he works hard to be accurate.
If you're not accurate, it's jarring for the reader. It takes them out of the moment. I made a gun mistake in my first book. Worst mistake you can make is a gun mistake, to have all the people write and tell you how you got the gun wrong.
Moving around again, over the bridge from Georgetown to the Iwo Jima Memorial, the massive bronze statue of Marines planting the flag, where two people are killed by snipers in House Divided.
I could walk down here and see, well, this is where the body's at, and this is the street, and there's the memorial. And up there in those trees is where the snipers were, and the view of one of them was blocked by the memorial before he could take the shot. He had to wait till the guy cleared the memorial.
Do you do this a lot? Do you come to Washington and walk around and try to figure out how something would work if it really did happen here?
I do. But I'm not actually doing like you would in a movie, just laying it out, you know, frame by frame, except in my head.
Arlington Cemetery's Tomb of the Unknowns is just down the river. The cemetery is in several of Lawson's books because, he says, everyone knows what it looks like, and it sets a tone.
It's beautiful, it's poignant, and then, you know, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers is just it's a remarkable place. And then I ended up using, you know, the soldiers themselves in the sixth book, House Divided.
The sentinels at the Tomb of the Unknowns, changing the guard, marching with beautiful precision, guarding the peace of the dead. Lawson gives them a surprising role in House Divided. We watched a guard change that day at Arlington, and Lawson described a scene at the tomb from that book.
One of the last scenes in the book, one of the guys who truly is kind of a bad guy, he's conflicted at this point. He used to be one of the sentinels, and he comes up here at dawn, and you can, you know, see from there the Washington Monument, and it's dawn, and he's thinking about what he's doing and what he used to be like when he was one of those sentinels. And again, I like that image of him being conflicted, and here's this pure scene of the guard at the tomb, and this bad guy thinking about what he's doing.
What he's been doing is following the orders of a rogue general. Now, as a person who knows her way around the basements of the Capitol, I can say that Mike Lawson mostly gets it right. His scoundrels are a little more vivid, perhaps. His hero is a big lug who plays dumber than he really is. Most Washington thrillers are exasperating to the locals. These are entertaining. And I guess I would like to live in a Washington where the good guys always win.
NPR's Linda Wertheimer reporting.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign, also offering a variety of tea and chai, open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
And here is the writer's almanac for Monday. It's the 9th of July, 2012. It's the birthday of Dame Barbara Cartland, author of several hundred books, most of them romance novels, born in Birmingham, England, 1901. Published her first novel when she was 25. It was called Jigsaw. From the 1970s onward, she produced an average of 23 books a year, and when she died in 2000, she left behind 160 manuscripts. It's the birthday of Oliver Sacks, born in London, 1933, to an extended family of doctors and scientists and religious Zionists. Oliver Sacks, who became a doctor, neurologist, and who has turned case studies of patients with neurological conditions into narratives. In 2001, he wrote a memoir, Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood, in which he talks about his childhood in England during World War II, his uncle Dave, who made light bulbs, and his older brother, Michael. Both brothers, Oliver and Michael, had been sent to a boarding school during the war, suffered horrible conditions, routinely whipped and bullied, and at the age of 15, his brother began exhibiting symptoms of psychosis. He saw messages everywhere, felt his thoughts were being read. And to cope with the trauma of his brother's illness, Oliver Sacks sought refuge in the neat, orderly, periodic table of elements, sometimes thought about becoming a chemist. And though he went into medicine, he still likes to give elements as birthday gifts. He said, 10 is element 50, and since 10 people have turned 50 lately, I'm out of 10. A good friend of mine was 80 recently, and I said to him, I wish you were 79.